Hello and welcome back to the Football Heritage Extra. I'm your host Rory Bryce and today I'm joined by Mike Donovan.
Hi Rory.
Hi Mike, it's good to have you on.
And me, likewise.
Good, glad to hear it. Mike is joining us today because he has recently written and published a book on the life and story of Danny Blanchflower, one of Tottenham Hotspur's probably most famous players, I would say, one of Northern Ireland's most famous players as well. We're going to be talking all about the history and story of Danny Blanchflower and then a little bit about the process for Mike writing the book. Just before we kick things off properly, Mike, why don't you tell myself and our listeners a little bit more about yourself?
Well, I'm a Spurs fan and also a journalist and an author. I thought I'd combine the two by writing books on players that I grew up with. And one of them was Danny Blanchflower. I've done a few in the past, Jimmy Greaves and Terry Dyson, Cliff Jones. Alan Gilsing, done a few. That's basically it. All these projects are labours of love, really, as you described them as.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what we often find out with people that we get on the show to speak about these autobiographies and these publications that they write about players, because, you know, obviously you can write about a club. Clubs have lasted forever, they'll outlast us. We can talk about, obviously, we always talk about the different culture and heritage aspects within football. And again, they outlast us. But when people write and talk about football players, it's a lot more personal because a lot of the time, football players, specific football players, are the thing that impacts us and draws us into a football club. And sometimes it's the very first experience of us actually enjoying football when we see that specific player that we immediately fall in love with.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's like music, isn't it? When you're growing up, it's the first music you hear, it sort of stays with you, and you try and keep up to date as best you can. But really, in your heart, it's the first love, and certainly Spurs was, and Danny Blanchflower was in the first match I ever saw Spurs play. So, you know, he was right there at the start. If we want to talk a bit about him, I mean, what he brought to the club. I mean, that team he was in that won the double, won the European Cupman's Cup, the first British team to do so, was rated probably the best in the world at the time. And he basically was the orchestrator of that team on and off the pitch, really. With Bill Nicholson, the manager, off the field, he had plenty of say-so, and Bill Nicholson allowed him the rein to do so, which I think shows great humility from Bill Nicholson, and it paid off. Now, Danny was a kind of multitasker, really. I mean, he was a journalist in the late 40s, early 50s. So he combined his football with his journalism.
And he was an RAF pilot before that as well.
He was, yeah, that's right. He was in the RAF. He just missed out on being sent off to combat in the Far East because the Japanese decided to surrender just before he was going out. But he lied about his age, I think, at the time, and was very young when he was doing all this. So, fascinating character. I mean, he's been voted the most important player Spurs have ever had. Was his influence, because I mean that team was probably the greatest team Spurs have ever had. Him and Bill Nicholson, I guess. It was just kismet, you know, the whole thing. It was one moment of magic. You could have 11 all-star players, and they might not click. Whereas this one clicked, and it's through Danny who guided all these top class players and made the team what it was, you know. And he wasn't a spectacular footballer in many ways. He was an attacking midfielder. I would describe him as a great passer, and he's very very bright. He was an intellectual, really, very very bright, and he on the field, he could actually see the spaces and how the game played. You know, he's one of these, you know, it was just a natural, like an automatic thing. He knew exactly how the play was going on and knew where the gaps were, and he knew in it, and they all had immense respect for him. You know, these players who were giants in the game themselves. always kind of listened to what he had to say, and it was always good advice. I mean, he was a very opinionated guy, but it was all come from a good place, you know?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, I think just to speak about his career a little bit, he started at Glentoran. You know, this is the era of football where you didn't really have things like academies. More often than not, you started off at your local side, you know, whether it was an amateur club, whatever, you started off at your local side and then a scout came and picked you up. And in this case, it kind of came a little bit late to the game because he started playing for Glentoran in 1946, although he'd played a little bit before that. But then he signed for Barnsley for £6,000 in 1949, which at that time was a lot of money. Then went on to Villa, where he really kind of broke through, and then he went to Spurs, and from there the rest is history. I mean, he spent a decade at Spurs, and as you say, he's recognised as one of the most important footballers in the history of the club, which is just absolutely amazing considering the background that he came from.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, yeah, I mean, it's, I mean, I always find in these books that I find the early days probably the most fascinating part of the book because they come from humble backgrounds. Danny was born in a working class area and East Belfast, sort of in the shadow of the shipyards that built the Titanic. You know, he's a very ordinary background, but he was extraordinarily bright, you know, and football was, you know, it was one, just one of the games, you know, he used to kick a ball about in the street, you know, discovered the game when he was 2 years old, standing balancing on a windowsill, scared the life out of his mum. and from then on, it was, you know, they used to, you know, it's the times when they used to go out in the street. I mean, remember, he was growing up when the the general strike was on when he was the year he was born, and it was tough, tough times. And yeah, he had this self-confidence. I think, early on, he had this really self-belief, you know, complete self-belief, and when he was younger, he was maybe a bit more naive when he kind of accepted contracts that he didn't quite understand, but he soon got to grips with that, all his clubs found out. Some great, some very funny stories, you know, about him when he signed from Aston Villa to Spurs. And let's go with the Barnsley. When he joined Barnsley from Glentoran, he didn't want to fall out with the Anglesey, the Barnsley manager, but he says, can I have a football to train? Because they never used to use footballs. And the argument put to him, so he said, was that, we starve you to football during the week, so you'd be more hungry the weekend. and his reply to that was, I might not recognise a football by the time I get there, you know. And he was ready with a quick whip all the time. But he was very very, very strong-minded and very, very innovative. He was for the good of the game, but a very sporting character, you know. And I think, you know, even his early days with Glentoran and all the way through, really. And as you said, he was a bit of a late bloomer in many ways, where he was sort of quite a slight build. And, you know, clubs in those days tended to sort of like bigger built youngsters and who couldn't be knocked off the ball too easily. And he was... I think they didn't want to take a chance on him. And then eventually, Barnsley did, but he was still kind of, although he was clearly the best player at Barnsley by miles and at Aston Villa, really, it wasn't until he got to Spurs. And that, I mean, that was a slow burner. I mean, he joined in 54, and of course the double was in 61 when he was about, you know, mid 30s. I mean, it's kind of crazy when all the success he's known for happened so late in his career, you know. The whole process of writing the book has been fascinating. It's largely trying to find a hook for it. It would have been his 100th year of his birth this year. His son Richard, his only son, I managed to establish some contact with him, and he's been so supportive of the whole thing. And obviously, he had a font of stories. And as I say, it was a fundamental part of why this book, you know, why I found this hook, a really, really good hook to base the book on, really.
Yeah, I'm with you. So obviously, you know, as you've mentioned, you've written about other players before. We have another person who is a frequent contributor to the podcast and articles on our website Colin Whelan, who has written books like Super Squad, where he goes in, talks about these different footballers, and then tries to build, you know, the best England 11, the best Scotland 11 out of these Maverick players. You know, we've spoken about Stan Bowles before, Pat Nevin, etc. Obviously, as I said, Mike, you've spoken about a number of other players before, but, you know, you're a Spurs fan yourself. What was it that drew you to Danny Blanchflower specifically? When did you first see him in action, and what impact did it leave in you when you saw him play?
Well, it was back in 61. But it wasn't the double year. It was it was in the autumn of that year, so the following season, and I saw him play Leicester. I mean, it was one of those, I'm sure you, when you, Celtic Park or wherever, when you stepped up onto the terracing and looked at that green swathe in front of you with the stands and everything, you know, it's kind of love at first sight. And that was what it was for me. And then to see the greatest team Spurs have ever had performing in front of my eyes. And then of course, they go and lose that game. So, as I said to you, other players probably caught the eye more because, I mean, he was very, he used his brain ahead of everything else. I mean, he was quite slight, so he was very smart, avoided the tackling. He left that to Dave McKay to get stuck in or Peter Baker behind him when he was moving forward. But he was very astute, used his brain more than brawn, you know, as a player. But he was a great, great captain. I mean, that's maybe what we haven't sort of spoken about, really. I mean, that's probably his strength. He was a great leader. You know, for my money, the greatest captain Spurs have ever had, and one of the greats of the game in that regard. Because, as I said to you earlier, everything he did was for the good of the game. You know, it was this famous glory quote he's always associated with. You know, the game's about glory. Because he wanted the game played in a certain way. I mean, you know, obviously, you know, you need to have that. You want to win, but also it had to be done with style. You know, that was really his big thing, and he kind of and of course that's all sprayed around the Spurs stadium to this in this today. You know, you see, you know, the game's about glory is all over the new stadium, and. And it's the Spurs way, you know. I mean, the Spurs have had this history from when they formed in 1882. They had to play a certain way. It wasn't good enough just to win. And I think that Danny Blanchflower epitomised that more than probably anybody else.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say, you know, I'm always cautious about making these comparisons. You know, football is so different now to how it was in the 50s and 60s, you know, tactically, athletically, whatever else. And it's topical given the season that Spurs are currently having, but, I mean, he would waltz into this team.
I would say so. I mean, this is the thing about the book. I think it's a bit of an antidote for what's going on at the moment, you know, with the Zerbi and, I mean, everything's going, the results and everything that's going on. And, I mean, this is why we should never forget these guys, you know, because they make your chest swell with pride, you know. You think, well, this is what Danny Blanchflower and his ilk gave this club. And this is why, as I said to you earlier, about history informing the present, you know, those guys made Spurs what they are today. And really, we're not really talking much about his previous clubs, but, I mean, he was at Aston Villa who'd won all sorts of stuff when he joined, but he felt that they were living on past glories, and he felt Spurs were the team for him. In fact, he chose Spurs over Arsenal in the end, which was quite an interesting one. Funnily enough, Arsenal came in for him very, very early when he joined, when he came from Glentoran to Barnsley. He was just about to sign for Barnsley, and Arsenal got wind of it. It must have sort of been sort of following him from a distance, and they got a scout in who tried to tap him up, you know. And this is where his honourable side came in, and, you know, he was really kind of offended by that somebody could do something underhand. And he turned him down flat, and, you know, and he said, you know, and he joined Barnsley. And then when he was at Aston Villa, and Arsenal and Spurs were vying for a signature, Arsenal... said manager Tom Whittaker said, look, we'll match anything we'll beat any price anybody wants to offer. When it came to it, they didn't. And Spurs won the, you know, they were just those two, and Spurs won the race. Arthur Rowe convinced him by talking more about the football rather than the money. He wasn't really he wasn't motivated by vast salaries. He, you know, although he fought for the abolition of the maximum wage, but he was, I don't know, he's a unique individual. I mean, I know it's, you know, I hate using that word as a journalist. It's one you should never use, really, because, you know, but he's a complete one-off, you know. It's hard to sort of describe, I mean, because I don't know another footballer, you know. I mean, he could go on to Panorama or become friends with a philosopher and talk philosophy. And, I mean, you know, I mean, it's just crazy, you know. I know we've all got an image of the archetypal footballer. He doesn't really fit at all. He's incredible. And, you know, I mean, for Ireland, of course, we haven't really gone on to Ireland, but, I mean, he did so much for Ireland. I mean,
massively so. And his brother was a good footballer as well, of course. We've not even mentioned that his family had footballing pedigree as well, obviously, his brother. Unfortunately, had to cut his career was cut short due to the injuries he sustained in the Munich air disaster. But, you know, the football DNA ran in the family.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, it was through his mum, actually.
That's right. Yeah,
his mum was a footballer in the family. Yeah, Selina. I mean, she used to go out and join in the street kickabouts, and people thought she was Danny's sister. You know. She actually played organised football, as women's football. I mean, she's kind of ahead of her time now, because obviously women's football is now big news. But then it was kind of, you know, obviously not, the complete opposite. And, you know, his mum seemed to be quite a character. I mean, this is what I found fascinating, just getting the... trying to get some insights into family life and, you know, what it was like. As I said to you, it was pretty poor. You know, they were a pretty poor bit. I mean, Dad worked in the shipyard and earned a few bob, but tough times, you know. And he emerged out of that, you know. He's quite a character.
Yeah, and we've seen it before when, you know, being brought up in environments like that can inform how these footballers turn out. It can really mold them into the people that they become. Again, I've mentioned it so many times on our main show podcast, there's a book called The Three Kings by Leo Moynihan, which talks about Busby Shankly and Jock Stein and how their backgrounds as miners within Scotland shaped them and made them into the people that they became, to become some of the greatest managers that have ever been within football in the UK, you know, and it's incredible looking at how these industrial backgrounds have actually influenced what they then put onto the football pitch. And it's exactly the same with Danny Blanchflower. It's the industrious spirit behind it, I think.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And well, Alex Ferguson's a classic example, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
His dad seems to be a shop steward for a union or something. And, you know, yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's a strange thing, I think, you know, if you've got a silver spoon in your mouth, you tend to, and all the talent in the world, maybe you don't get on. But if you've got a modicum of skill and a background like that, where you want to get out of your poverty trap, I guess that's one motivation. But it's kind of I mean, it's character building and all the other cliches you can think of. But I think you're right. I think his background certainly. Helped motivate, because he was kind of, say, he was single-minded. He was kind of like, he sort of knew what he wanted. I mean, he got to university, you know. I mean,
yeah.
At a time when, I mean, it was unthinkable, you know. And I certainly think that he wanted a better life himself. He was a bit restless, you know. He kind of like, he had ambitions, you know. He wasn't sort of happy, you know. I mean, a lot of people from working class backgrounds can slip into this way of well, that's my lot in life, you know, and just earn a few bob for the family. Whereas he was kind of like, he had this kind of attitude. Well, stuff this, I'm not, you know, I want more, you know, I want more. And he went out and did it. And I mean, he did it with Northern Ireland in the World Cup. I mean, he kind of so we alluded to Jackie earlier, and Jackie, I mean, I think he rated Jackie as a better footballer than he was. The Munich. Well, if you remember, Munich was in the February 1958, and the World Cup that Danny Branchflower, which was captain of Northern Ireland, was in the summer of that year, and I mean, to lose one of their best players was a blow. And I mean, Northern Ireland, as of today, haven't got a large pool of players to choose from, and but they. They, Danny Blanchflower and Peter Doherty, who's he's a famous player who Danny Blanchflower absolutely worshipped. You know, one of those guys when you're in the playground or, you know, over the park kicking a ball about, you know, you pretended to be Peter Doherty. And he was a kind of a massive influence. And again, it's a bit like the Bill Nicholson, Danny Blanchflower link up, really, where they just had something special for Northern Ireland. You know, Peter Doherty was the manager of Northern Ireland. They were the smallest, I think, they're the smallest country to participate in the World Cup, you know, at that time. And they not only beat Italy to qualify, funnily enough, having remembered what happened the other week, but he, so they beat, I mean, well, that's another story again. You have to read the book, I guess. they got through that, and then they got to the quarterfinals of the World Cup. You know, two matches from. I mean, it's just unthinkable. You know, England got knocked out early on. I think it was the only World Cup where all the home nations were involved. I mean, I say alongside this is all his writing, and I mean, I keep saying it, but a one-off, you know. Julie Welch is the author and writer, who's a very much respected lady there's a lot of people helped me with this book, to be honest, but she was great. And she's described him as a one-off, and it's a cliche, but he was. I can't think of anybody like him. And, you know, I mean, but I mean, it's a fascinating story. I mean, I tried to make it like a narrative, but also slip in individuals who knew him. So I just sort of divided up. So I ensured that the narrative carried on, but in between, it's all the people who knew him with their stories, his family and his colleagues, and anybody who kind of admired him.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing at the end of the day, because we can sit and we can read the Wikipedia page for these footballers, and we can read, you know, their stats, what their career trajectory was, but that's not going to give you the idea of the person that they are. That's just going to give you the numerical breakdown and a narrative of their life.
Absolutely.
If we really want to get the most out of these players and remembering them, then we need to hear the stories.
Absolutely. I mean, these people, that's why I found that, you know, I must say, you know, that I was absolutely getting hold of members of the family. And I mean, made contact with his sister, with Danny's sister, who's quite an age. And his niece, who's Jackie's daughter, was extremely helpful and supportive of the. I mean, this is what I mean. Everybody I got hold of was supportive of the project, you know. And I just love doing it. I mean, it's a lot of hard work, I've got to say, you know. But you know, it's worth it, I think, you know, because now I've got, there's something there on the people's bookshelves, hopefully, you know, that they can, that stands as a testament to you know, one of the greatest footballers and personalities that played the game, you know. And I'm probably speaking from a biased viewpoint, but I think he would be recognised. He knew a lot of people around the world. You know, in his time, you know, people like Frederick Puskas, you know, who was a big influence on Ange Postecoglou, of course. I mean, he knew a lot of people. You know, he used to go on the Parky chat shows, and I mean, such a great talker, you know, and so eloquent and amusing, and he's a great character.
Yeah, exactly. That is all that we can really say about him. He was a great character. So, what's the plans for your next book then, Mike? Obviously, you've not long launched this one. Who's the next footballer that you're going to cover?
Well, I don't know. I bet I'm going to hedge my bets on that one, because it's time consuming, and it's a bit unfair on my home life, really, because, you know, I've left it to my poor wife to kind of keep the house running and keep everything else going. So I might take a breather, and I've done a book on my own football experiences called A Fever Paunch, I've called it, because we're all of that age and of that that build. I like little fun projects like that. I'm getting to music. I like my music, so I might even veer off into that, but I can't give you a definitive answer on that one, I'm afraid.
That's all right. Rory. That's all right.
You know, it feels a bit of a privilege, you know. I mean, I can't believe sometimes I'm sort of standing there talking to Richard Blanchflower and Pat Jennings and, you know, all these people. Like, I mean, you know, Richard, because of obviously for his dad, and also and Pat, because I thought he was the best goalkeeper I've ever seen. And a lovely, lovely guy. And he did a forward for me, actually, Pat. It was very kind of him. I mean, because he played for Danny when Danny was manager of Northern Ireland. So, yeah, it's I wouldn't swap it. You know, it's just great. It's a great, you know, when you see it, when you pick up the book, the greatest thrill for me when I write a book is to actually see it, you know, get it, clutch it in my hand, like an album with vinyl, you know.
Yeah.
You see a vinyl record, and rather than something that's streamed that comes and goes, you've got something that you can hold in your hand and look at it and say, you know, particularly with books, I did that. I mean, sort of quietly proud of it, you know. And
it should be. It's having the tangible thing that you're holding and you're saying, well, this was me that made this.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, A Glorious Life, you know, it's a... Yeah, for Danny Blanche. I mean, and it certainly was. I mean, it's certainly an amazing, amazing figure. And as you say, what they could do, players like him now, and he would certainly lift their confidence. I mean, the confidence is a massive thing at the moment, I think. And it's kind of like on the floor. And what's going on behind the scenes as well, you know, and the fans getting uppity. And it's, but as I say, if you read about Danny Blanchflower, it would cheer you up. And it's not just about Spurs. It's about a lot of things.
I completely agree with you. And whatever your next project is, I wish you all the best with it. But what we'll do is we'll put links to your books in the show notes for this episode, Mike, so our listeners can go and check them out. Please do go and pick up Mike's book on Danny Blanchflower as well. Really excellent insight into his life. And as I said earlier on, it's not like a lot of the other books which just rehashes the Wikipedia article on the player. It actually dives into some of the stories about the person as well, from the people who were in and around him as he grew up. But Mike, this has been fantastic. Is there anything else that you want to add just before we finish up for today?
Well, no. I'm just grateful for your interest, Rory. I mean, I always feel these people are forgotten about. You know, a lot of today, you know, you're going to the Spurs Superstore, and it's very hard to find any books in there. It's all shirts and cups and bits and bobs that people fly in from Scandinavia or wherever pick up, and it's not really. I don't know. There's not enough emphasis on books, on reading books. You know, it's. I think more and also for remembering these guys. You know, for remembering what they did for the club, because it's kind of, you know, I mean, you'll know with the Lisbon Lions, and these guys made what your club is today. And I'm very passionate on that. I mean, that's a real strong motivator for me. I don't think it's recognised enough, you know.
Yeah, it's all very interesting, and I agree with you that trying to preserve the memory of these people who made our clubs what they are is one of the most important things that we can do as football fans. But Mike, thank you very much for your time this afternoon, and thank you very much to all of our listeners and our paid subscribers who've tuned in for this episode. If you have any questions, or if you want to suggest a topic yourself, you can DM us on any of our social media, or you can also email us at hello@footballheritage.co.uk. Please also remember to check out our main show podcast, which comes out every single Monday on primarily Spotify, Apple, and YouTube. We'll see you all again next week. Goodbye.